cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
I want to kind of say our next guest, but I feel like we are the guests in the House of NJIT. But our next guest did begin his tenure as the president of NJIT in July. He's a mechanical engineer by training. We are so delighted to be here at NJIT with Tech Lim. Thank you so much, first of all, for having us back here.
Well, Carol, thanks for coming, you know.
I just feel like the work that you guys are doing with students and your focus obviously on engineering and science, but we're going to talk a lot about sustainability. And it was interesting that here we were talking about someone who has been, you guys are disrupting, you're innovating. Elon Musk, definitely a big disruptor and innovator. You've actually met him.
Yes. When I was, this is many, many moons ago, when I was a dean of the College of Engineering and Applied Science in Cincinnati, there's this Hyperloop competition that he was organizing, and our team made it to the final round, so I met him in Los Angeles. And the thing that reminds me about him, okay, he told me, he said that, you know, we are a three-dimensional being, but we travel on two-dimensional surface. That's why we have traffic jam.
So he was like trying to figure out how do we do it differently.
That's right, yeah. He's a disruptor, definitely. Now, talking about disruption, one of the reasons why I'm attracted to NJIT is the innovation and the entrepreneurship that occurs over here. And I believe this place is probably one of the most innovative, one of the most entrepreneurial minded place in terms of academic institution in America. Do you know why?
Mm-mm.
Well, two reasons, I think. One is the diversity on this campus. The diversity brings the diversity of thoughts,
Tim
ideas.
Said walking in, he's like, I don't know that I've ever, or... What did you say? I don't want to take the words out.
Well, I mean, my college experience was my college experience, and it was not one of diversity. I mean, I went to college in Central Maine, and it was a lot of white kids.
Yeah. We call ourselves a minority-majority institution. No one race dominates. Not just the diversity of race, but diversity of demographic thoughts and international diversity. That's one reason why we're innovative and entrepreneurial. The second one, okay, being in the midst of New York metropolitan, how can we not be innovative and diverse?
Right.
And also entrepreneurial, right?
Well, I mean, and the I can just imagine kind of the level of conversation, right? Or just as you guys are doing in your classes, the level by having such a diverse student base, it's just a different experience, right?
Definitely, yeah. I would say NJIT is one of the top, because of our diversity mm-hmm. that feeds into it, one of the top research institutions in this country. And it gives us a lot of opportunity to have further engagement with industry. I always believe that the translation from research to, you know, commercializing to industry is part of the initiative that any institution, any polytech institution, especially like NJIT, should embrace in. So, for example, you know, we have recently two major collaborations. One is the pharmaceutical giant Merck that established the Merck Digital Science Studio. Mm-hmm. And we believe this studio is going to generate innovative technologies that for drug discovery and development. That's one. Second one, okay, is our partnership with McKinsey. It's called the McKinsey Digital Capability Lab. And it's one of the only McKinsey Digital Capability Lab that focuses on life sciences. McKinsey have other labs around the world, but this is the only one that focuses on life sciences. So these two examples show that we are very engaged with industry.
That's the one thing I think is really interesting about the involvement of private sector.
Yeah, and a lot of it also has to do with the location. And I'm wondering mm-hmm. from the perspective of how you've seen things change over the past couple of years. You know, in the height of the pandemic, we saw a lot of colleges go remote. I know you were at the University of Texas Arlington during that time. But if you think about that experience and bringing it here and the idea of disrupting education, how do you continue to attract students to pay tuition in an age where many people say, okay, well, I want to learn something, I can go on YouTube and do it. Khan Academy exists. Why should I pay tens of thousands of dollars to go to a school to do it?
Well, first of all, let's go back to the pandemic. Of course, we do not want to ever wish for a pandemic. Many people suffer for that, but the silver lining behind the pandemic is it's propelled higher ed far out into the future that faster or earlier than we expected. So higher ed is going through a digital revolution right now. And those institutions that embrace digital revolution, and like we do right now, we have a digital strategy that would incorporate use of technology in teaching, research, service, anything that we do, including engagement with industry. Those who can do that well, okay, will flourish and will do well. Those who don't will be left behind. So that's the change that's going on. The other thing that's changed, okay, is like you say, you know, this is the digital revolution. You can almost learn anything on the internet. Yes and no. Education is actually very holistic. Okay, I call it the education of the mind, the heart, and the soul, because it's not just learning something on the internet. It is the engagement, the collaboration with your peers, with faculty, with the industry that matters. And this is one of the reasons why we need to engage externally. We need to collaborate with industry because we need to bring this experiential learning
right
on campus so that our students can learn so much more.
Can't be in vacuums, right?
That's right.
Otherwise, it's not going to be real use knowledge that can be put to work. Just got about 30 seconds left. How do you make sure that you're catching on to the trends that are going to matter in the years to come? And unfortunately, we've only got about 30 seconds.
Right, yeah. Well, so much to talk about. But one thing I want to focus on, okay, is sustainability. Okay, we on this campus does not just embrace sustainability. We do research in sustainability. We practice sustainability.
Right.
Do you know that 100% of our energy use on this campus now is through hydropower?
No, I didn't know that.
And we probably have a lot of strength in terms of our construction project and our energy utilization in making it more sustainable.
And we're going to talk more about these conversations. And he's telling us about the energy too, because I'm like, can we kick up the air conditioning? He's like, it's sustainable.
Sustainable, right? Yeah.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We are live at NJIT. Our next guest helped provide solutions on the remediation of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. That was some 11 million gallons of oil into Prince William Sound. That was back in 89. That was the worst oil spill in U.S. waters until Deepwater Horizon. That was in 2010.
Our next guest worked on solutions for that one as well. And he's with us here at New Jersey Institute of Technology. We've got Dr. Michel Bouffedel, Professor of Environmental Engineering and Director of the Center for Natural Resources at NJIT. Good to have you with us, Professor. Really appreciate you taking the time this afternoon. Take us back to that time, 1989 and then 2010, okay. And how you helped clean those oil spills up.
Yeah, for the Exxon Valdez oil spill, actually, we got involved in the second phase of remediation. In 2006, there was a reopener between the Department of Justice and the Exxon company, Exxon Mobil company, and the government was asking for more money, they call it due to unforeseen damages. So we went there, and there was like about 100 tons of oil remaining in the beaches. So we got there, and then we investigated why is it that the oil persisted. You know, it was everything in the 90s assumed that, the oil would disappear by that time. And we found that the oil is trapped like between two layers in the beaches. And we proposed a solution that we implemented, which is called bioremediation, mm-hmm. which consists of enhancing the growth of microorganisms in the beach, and then they can eat up the oil. So that was, you know, our proposed solution. There are other solutions, or you know, one could consider, but we thought that that's more natural. But any, I would say, any solution for dealing with an environmental damage, there's always some disruption. So you know, if you ask me, like, is it always to do bioremediation?
No.
I would say, yeah, you cannot tell every time. You know, sometimes you know you wanna weigh in the disruption. Some beaches, I think, it's ideal. Other beaches, maybe. You know, they are, you know, you want to consider other options.
Dr. Bufadel, what I want to ask you is that every time something happens, whether it's deep water, whether it's Valdez, whether it's a pandemic, when we do something to our environment, we lose something. Even if you can fix the situation, right, and get it maybe, I mean, do we ever go right back to where we were, or no, we've lost something?
Oh, I think that's a philosophical question. Yes.
You're a scientist, though, but do we,
yes,
when we impact
I
the environment, is the environment so sturdy and durable that it comes back?
Well, for example, let's talk about Deepwater Horizon. You know, there's no doubt that some aspects, some areas, they will never recover. Some wetlands, some coral reefs, they will not recover. But again, you know, you want to weigh it at, you know, at the larger scale.
Mm-hmm.
I think to a large degree, you know, for what humans want from maybe the Gulf of Mexico, I think they are getting now. There are damages still to the ecosystem, but in terms of the fishing industry, it returned and it's thriving. So, but again, this was a horrendous spill. And of course, you know, 11 people died. So it is, you know, it caused a lot of damage to the environment.
One thing that we've learned over the last year is that the world is a lot more reliant on oil than I think a lot of people understood. And we're a lot earlier in the transition away from natural resources than we were, well, than I think a lot, again, than I think a lot of people thought. How do you think about the balance between, well, needing to power the Earth, but also at the same time needing to prevent climate change from accelerating?
I think it's really, we are in a tough spot because if we assume we want to go to renewable energy, let's say solar, well, we need then to obtain lithium. And then that, you know, you have, you know, mountaintop excavation and all kind of issues. We have other problems here in the U.S., which is that, let's say if we decided to switch to electrical, okay, just to charge the cars, you know, the grid, you know, cannot handle it. So you need a lot of money invested. I think one of the solutions would be maybe mobile storage, you know. With climate change, also the, you know, the other challenge that we have is that there's excess heat, especially in cities, and you know, in many inner cities you have underserved communities, minorities, and you know, and people die. You know, it's to the excessive heat. Now, you know, you could say, okay, we can provide, you know, air condition, but still, you know, the grid might not handle it. So we need to have solutions that that are, as I give an example of mobile storage, for example, you know, you bring a big battery to a, an environment, you know, a neighborhood, and then
that needs it, and then move it around.
Yes, and move it around, and then charge it when it is off peak, and then you know, keep doing that. You know, following a disaster also.
We want to actually ask you about nuclear energy. Is this one of the answers going forward?
I'm sorry to laugh, just surprised, because, you know, typically as environmentalists, we've always seen that nuclear energy is a major problem. But at this juncture, I think this is it might be the solution. I think we need to have nuclear energy. It needs to be safe.
Can it be safe,
well,
truly?
I mean, it is always a risk management issue. I mean, do people, we know of major accidents, which caused, for example, Germany to, you know, Angela Merkel to move away from nuclear, but then now they have this major crisis there in terms of energy. I think, you know, at this moment, I mean, I shouldn't say just at this moment, for the last few years, I'm seeing it that we need to move to nuclear. Because whatever,
so it's not solar, it's not wind, these are not necessarily the solutions?
No, I mean, like, for example, you hear that about hydrogen, you know, it's essentially that instead of using methane gas, which is greenhouse gas, it kind of causes a warming of the earth, let's use hydrogen. But to get hydrogen, you need energy to break the methane to get the hydrogen, okay? So, but I feel nuclear at this moment, it seems, you know, the best solution.
20 seconds, what's your message to people who say, I'm scared because I know about Three Mile Island, know about Fukushima, and of course, what happened in Ukraine?
I mean, I think really the main message is that where are we going to be in the next 50 years? You know, yes, I understand that if it is next to your house, you're going to be worried, and we're all going to be worried, but it has to be collective. It is, you know, we cannot have one solution that works only for one neighborhood.
Yeah, or turn off your lights, everybody, right?
Yes.
And stop using so much energy. I know. There you go. Dr. Bouffidel, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Dr. Michelle Bouffidel of NJIT. This is Bloomberg.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, this week, a very unique issue of Bloomberg Business Week, the entire issue devoted to something that could upend in a big way how we transact in so many ways, easily the most talked about, talked up, talked down topic when it comes to financial disruption.
And it's something that already has a few boom and bust cycles, one of a bust right now. We're talking about crypto, of course. It's all in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It's already online and on the Bloomberg Terminal. The cover of the issue, the crypto story, your guide to where it came from, what it all means, and why it still matters. With more, we've got Pat Regnier, Bloomberg Businessweek Markets and Finance Editor. He edited the piece. Also, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber. They're both back in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio in New York. Joel, this is only the second time that Bloomberg Businessweek has ever devoted an entire issue to one topic, one story written by one author. Why Matt Levine and why crypto?
That's a great question. The first one that you're referring to there was What is Code by Paul Ford. That was before I was actually editor, 7 years ago. And it was a feat. And it's always just stuck with me as a Herculean effort to have one author go cover to cover. But you can't do it every year on any given topic. And then crypto has been just honestly, as a financial journalist, it's been an amazing story for a decade. And then to see what's sort of transpired over the last year, where it has just felt like a lot of air has come out of the balloon. And it just sort of makes you wonder, like, what was this thing that we've lived through for this past decade? And what help us make sense of that? And so as I sort of wrestled with this, and we had a very impromptu meeting to kind of figure out on the Business Week front some of the stories that we wanted to spool up. We had a little brainstorm, and the number one thing that I think collectively that group was like, we all want to read it, is like anything Matt Levine wants to say about crypto, we will publish that. And so in a one of my emails that I sent on June 17th with a subject line, crypto for BW, question mark, was to Matt Levine, asking him if he'd write, if he'd like to write 20,000 words, give or take 18,000. And, you know, it took him a week to respond, which, you know, I could tell maybe I planted the seed and then it festered for a little bit.
All right, so Pat, come in on here on this because it's an incredible story, and I have to say, I've already said to Joel, like, I started reading it, and I'm like, oh, I kind of start to get it after so many conversations, so many different interviews. What Matt writes in terms of how he kicks it all off, it starts to make sense. Crypto to me. How do you guys though work with Matt on this, because it's a massive project and it's broken down into parts? But how do you approach something this? What are the conversations you had back and forth with Matt about it?
Well, I mean, first, with something like this, you just ask him what he wants to do. He's such an accomplished writer that often the wisdom of editing is in knowing when to get out of somebody's way. But then to ask questions and to be a good interlocutor. I think there are different people on staff who think about crypto differently. I'm a crypto skeptic, and it was fun to bounce ideas off him. And I think the achievement of the piece is how demystifying it is. If I try to describe it to people, I say, this is a tool for thinking about this thing that's kind of captured so much of our attention. And it could take you in a lot of different directions. I think one thing that a lot of people feel about crypto is, let's say, for example, you're a crypto skeptic. You'll say, I'm skeptical of this, but I'm not sure I understand it well enough because it's sort of obfuscated in so many layers of detail. He'll break that down for you, and he'll show it to you, and you'll be able to think about it with an open mind. It might change your mind, but it also might actually take you to thinking about it in new ways. I think if you are a crypto fan, he might surprise you in like what he focuses on and what he doesn't. A lot of sort of the most important talking points of people who like crypto, you won't see much in this story. And then he's kind of drilling down into some of the financial market details of crypto and some of the surprising places that crypto went just in the past couple of years. And you may see new interesting opportunities in that or new places that crypto can go.
Hey, Joel, can you talk a little bit about the presentation of this piece? It's in the magazine, so it's in traditional magazine format, but it's completely, I don't want to say a completely different experience if you read it online. Can you just talk from an editorial perspective how you sort of make something unique online, but also you can digest it in a traditional format?
So the staff, several members have been around long enough that they worked on that code issue that I mentioned by Paul Ford. And so there were learnings from, you know, sort of how this is, you know, what how ambitious we can be with this. And, you know, the dirty little secret is that we built it really for web first because we wanted this presentation to be something that was just organic and in its kind of native form for the internet. And so we did that first and foremost. And then we basically have reverse engineered it from there into print. And it's almost going to be a one-to-one kind of transmission where we take everything that we've already done online and bring it into the magazine. And I think there will be there's some little, you know, bells and whistles that obviously aren't going to translate to print. But I think what we really tried to accomplish here was something that was timeless and felt like, you know, if you really only read one crypto story ever, and like, look, like, I think what's interesting about crypto, and it's very different than code, was that code is this invisible thing and around you, and it is the architecture on which our modern world's built. And then crypto is not like that. Like, you have people who believe and then people who don't believe. So it's this really divisive topic. But I think we've really tried to create something here where people on either side of that equation have something that they can read and understand. Like Pat said there, I think we tried to go out here and reach the widest possible audience with that. So we'll do that in print, and it'll be something that, you know, I think you will look back on this for years and be like, wow, there's like a little timestamp of what happened in 2022 when Bloomberg and Business Week said something big about this. And, you know, and all we ask of you is to spend 40,000 words reading it.
And also, I think, and well, you say that, Joel, and it's funny because I think also it can serve as a reference for people the way it's organized. Hey, Pat, we just have 30 mm-hmm. seconds left, but give us what you think Matt Levine's big takeaway is. I mean, obviously, I want people to read this, but what is the conclusion that he came to?
I think one thing is that he really focuses on how crypto is finance and some of the ways that it's very much like traditional finance, and that it's both repeating a lot of the mistakes of traditional finance, and it teaches you about finance. Another way of putting this is you could have made this story, What is Finance? You will learn a lot about markets by reading about this.
And this whole issue of trust.
It's
I just love
really
it.
Good.
So wait, Pat, are you still a skeptic? 10 seconds.
Yeah.
It took 10 seconds to answer that.
I sure am, but I don't think everybody's going to read it that way.
All right, Joel Weber, Pat Regnier, check it out, folks. It's online, incredible. It's the whole issue of Business Week.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
And a very good afternoon, everyone. Carol Messer along with Tim Stenovic. What's your name?
Tim Stenovic.
Okay, Tim Stenovic. Yeah.
We've only worked together for 2 years, so okay.
Yeah, it's just one of those days. We are live at New Jersey Institute of Technology. We are streaming on YouTube. We are on Bloomberg Quick Take and, of course, on Bloomberg Radio, and having some great conversations when it comes to the environment, sustainability, engineering, so much going on here at NJIT. And one thing we wanted to get into is what is called brownfields, because there's an estimated more than 450,000 brownfields in the United States. The EPA estimating that cleaning it up, reinvesting in these properties, increases local tax bases. We're talking about it brings about job growth. It also utilizes existing infrastructure. It does a lot to the economy.
We've got a guest with us who has a front row seat to all of this happening with the environment and the economy, Dr. Colette Santasiri, Executive Director of the New Jersey Brownfields Assistance Center. It helps the private and public sectors to reclaim and redevelop brownfield sites, an estimated 10,000 such sites here in New Jersey alone. Dr. Santasiri, good to have you with us. First of all, Carol, you were saying that you were asking the newsroom if people knew what a brownfield was.
So many people did not know.
One
that.
Of our producers did.
Sarah did. Sarah lives.
So
she knew.
Explain, Dr. Santasiri, what it is.
So thank you so much for having me here. I really appreciate it. I just wanted to mention that in addition to the New Jersey Brownfields Assistance Center that we have at NJIT, we also have the New Jersey Institute of Technology's Technical Assistance mm-hmm. to Brownfields Communities Program, which is an EPA-funded program. And we provide technical assistance beyond New Jersey to many different states and territories in the country. So going back to your question, when we talk about brownfields, it's always good to start with the definition
yeah.
because most people don't know what they are. So the EPA, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, defines a brownfield as real property, the redevelopment, expansion, or reuse of which may be complicated by the presence of or the potential presence of a contaminant, a pollutant, or a hazardous substance. Mm-hmm. And each state has their own definition, which is very similar to the federal definition, but it varies from state to state. So when you think about brownfields are those old mills and the closed factories and the junkyards and the dumps, the relics of our industrial legacy. Mm. But they're also the closed gas stations, the closed dry cleaners, and other commercial properties are considered brownfields if they, based on their past use, are contaminated or perceived to be contaminated.
Dry cleaners.
I know.
That's
well,
because really
think about the amount of chemicals, right, and
yeah.
stuff that's left over,
wow.
I guess. What's the difference between brownfields and Superfund sites?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that because we get asked that a lot. Superfund sites are heavily contaminated properties. There is regulations for Superfund sites versus regulations for brownfield sites. There mm-hmm. is funding for just Superfund sites. There's funding just for brownfield sites. So they're two different programs on the federal level. But as far as the sites go, Superfund sites are heavily contaminated. A lot of them present immediate or I guess could impact the community.
As they exist. Yeah.
Yeah. But with brownfields, it's really important to say that not all brownfields are contaminated. So you might have a closed auto repair facility.
What does that mean?
So, a gas station where they fixed cars, it's closed, it's abandoned. Based on past use, you would think there's contamination there. But once soil has been sampled and analyzed, the groundwater has been looked at, the building materials are looked at, there may be no contamination at all. Mm-hmm. But it is still a brownfield site because there's that perception of contamination.
Mm. Right.
So brownfields are really about pieces of property that have sat for years and sometimes decades without any development interest because, again, they're either contaminated or there's that perception of contamination.
Let's talk about remediation here because perception is certainly important. I brought this up a few weeks ago, Carol. There's an area where I live in Brooklyn. It's a gas station. It's like the only one in the neighborhood. It's for sale. And it's for sale for close to $20 million, which is crazy to me. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, obviously like some hotel or like huge apartment building is going to go up here. But in order to actually develop, if it's sold, mm-hmm. what does that gas station property have to do, or what do developers have to do in order to make it so, okay, people can live here, people mm-hmm. can be here?
First, they have to determine if there's contamination. So the soil is going to be sampled, groundwater underneath the property is going to be sampled, building materials are going to be sampled. If there is contamination, then that contamination has to be dealt with. It has to be remediated. There's all different ways to remediate contamination, and it really depends on the type of contamination. Some contaminated soil can just be scooped up and hauled away, and there's no more contamination. Some contaminants are allowed to stay on property as long as you cap them, like with a parking lot. The remediation really depends on the type of contamination, the extent of the contamination, but also what the end use is going to be. So the standards for cleaning up a site are much higher if residential use is going to be
but
there.
But if they're going to build another gas station there, then it kind of doesn't matter.
Well, the contamination still has to be remediated, but it might not be to the levels of cleanup as if you were putting a house there.
That's what I was going to say. If you're putting a school for kids or something,
right.
or a nursery or a
right.
hospital or a medical, right? Like a,
yep.
Some, there's different degrees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it really depends on the state you're in and the state regulations. But just in general, if you have a property where there's soil contamination and that contamination is not running off-site, it's not going into the groundwater, the remediation may be leaving that contamination and just capping that site, and you put a warehouse there. So the contamination, people are not coming into contact with that contamination because there is a cap. A warehouse end use is very different than a residential end use.
Right.
More than likely, that contamination has to be removed. And again, it depends state by state what the regulations are and the type of contamination.
Like, it's interesting that we're talking about this. This is obviously your world, right? And you're very entrenched in it, and this is across the country. What is it about what you're doing that might surprise our audience? And I think they're an investment audience. They're a smart audience. They understand things that are going on. First of all, I'm just kind of floored that there's so much property that's just sitting, you know, dormant, it sounds like. But mm-hmm. what would surprise people about what you are doing and the work you're doing?
So the work that we do at NJIT, we're a team of professionals. We're environmental planners, environmental scientists, social scientists, civil engineers. And our primary role in these brownfields programs that we have are to help communities overcome the challenges that brownfields are posing to those communities. So some of those challenges are, if there's a brownfield in a community that has been sitting there for years and decades, that really poses negative impacts on the community. It gives it a bad appearance.
Yeah.
People who live there are looking at that site wondering what's going on. Is there contamination? Is it, harming me? A lot of these communities don't have the in-house expertise or resources or knowledge on how to deal with these sites, from identifying brownfield sites to getting them cleaned up to redeveloping them. And so that's what our team does here.
So
at
you
NJIT.
Guys also help them finance it or pay for it, or how does that work?
Okay, so we don't give out money.
Right.
But the US EPA gives out a lot of money.
To do this.
States also have funds for this type of work. So what we do is we work with communities and help them. We identify different funding sources for them, and then we help them through the application process to get that funding. And then once they get that funding, we show them how to use it.
Mm-hmm. So before we let you go, I'm wondering if environmental standards right now have come to a point where there won't be brownfields when, you know, a dry cleaner is built in this day and age and that's removed 30 years from now.
Great question.
That's a great question. A lot of the brownfield sites we have, as I mentioned, are legacy, you know, industrial legacy. So a lot of those sites are going away. Our regulations are really strict on how we handle hazardous waste, how we handle chemicals on site. So that has helped get rid of a lot of brownfield sites. But things happen. Underground storage tanks leak. We spill on site. We might, you know, an industrial facility might be using some kind of hazardous waste and it gets spilled. Mm. And now we have contamination. Mm. But for the most part, our laws and regulations have been really strict and have helped to not only prevent future brownfield sites, but get the brownfield sites that we have cleaned up.
Dr. Santaseri, thank you so much. Really enlightening. Dr. Colette Santaseri, Executive Director of the New Jersey Brownfields Assistance Center, joining us here at NJ.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
STV is an engineering firm. It's been around for 100 years and counting. First set up shop in New York City in the Architects Building at 101 Park Avenue. I love the history of an institution. Well, more than 100 years later, it's now working all over the globe. Aviation, ports, energy, education, healthcare, military, residential, retail, hospitality. I haven't even touched.
Was there anything missing from that?
There is more.
Did you say rail?
I didn't.
Okay, rail as well.
Thank you.
We've got Kimber Heilig here, President of Buildings and Facilities Division at STV, also a member of the company's executive leadership team, an architect who got a Master's of Science in Management from NJIT, which we're broadcasting from today. She's a LEED accredited professional joining us here at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. How are you?
Very well. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about what it means to design from the ground up something sustainable, specifically when it comes to schools. I mean, we think about it in the you know, conversation of flooding, I think, you know, when we're near the coast and when we're worried about sea level rise. But how do you think about it?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Every school we design, we really have to think about the geography that it's located in and how that's going to impact how we design. I have to say that building new schools is something that we don't often get to do because there's so much existing building stock that we have to work with. And that's one of the challenges is, you know, if you have an existing building, how do you start working sustainability into that, right? Because you can't take the walls down, right?
Right.
You have to think about, can I use solar to maybe offset some of the energy costs?
Well, you know, what's right. So interesting, it just, there's the school in my neighborhood mm-hmm. is, my friend used to teach there, and it was actually designed in the wake of the last pandemic. So it has extra big windows for ventilation.
Yes.
Which
oh,
is,
wow.
So if you think about 100
years
ago.
Last pandemic, 100 years ago.
100 years ago,
that's
yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, so I mean, what is, so fast forward to, you know, 100 years later.
Yeah.
What do you prioritize in design?
Well, and it's funny you say that because daylighting is one of the most important things as you think about a school. And yes, that goes into the sustainability narrative with how do you bring down electric costs, right, and lighting. But the truth is that educational student achievement is really tied to daylighting. So the more daylighting that students receive, the higher their reading and their math scores are. So it's just not about sustainable design
for the environment. Is daylighting exactly what it sounds like? Just windows that allow...
Windows, more light,
letting
right?
light in, right?
Let there be light.
Right. Yeah. And it's that connection to nature too, right? I mean, even the mental health aspects, which we see not just in schools, but even as we think about office buildings and how now they're being thought about. It's just not about enclosing someone in an office.
Well, I think about this incredible space that we're in right now at NJIT. We are very lucky when I go back to the Bloomberg headquarters, and it's this wonderful, well-lit, windows everywhere, open space. When it comes to schools, like, what else is evolving in terms of how we teach kids? You talk about light. I get that. That is so important. What else?
Well, it's also flexible learning spaces, right? Mm-hmm. Our kids are no longer sitting in desks in rows because that's not what they're doing at home, right? They're so interactive with their iPads and their tablets and multimedia. And we really see that the educational facilities that produce the best students now are ones that allow that adaptive learning, right? Small group instruction, large group instruction, the ability to work around. And also the STEM learning, right? So we've done aerospace classrooms. We've done culinary labs.
What's an aerospace classroom?
Right, where you get to think about how you're designing airplanes, right? How is the wing of the airplane designed? Are we building it? And then are we testing it to see, you know, how all those things we're now doing at the high school level, which is so interesting. And it really propels students to figure out where they want to be and how they want to grow into their careers.
So cool.
What's the number one challenge when you think about climate change in terms of building design?
Probably budget, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, most of our clients are aware of the implications, right? Everyone wants to do the right thing, right? But let's face it, to build something is costly, right? And often the agencies don't have the money they need, the funds they need. So you have to make those really hard value decisions, right? How do I balance the right moves, the right choices for long term with the budget I have? Knowing
why is
I
it still expensive in terms of being more sustainable and more climate sensitive?
Well, some of it is the technology that's out there. But, you know, some things you can do that are economical and easy to do, like daylighting, right? But obviously glazing sometimes costs more than brick, right? So you have to balance those challenges. But buildings are 36% globally of the energy that gets spent, right? So we have to make these right decisions. And a building, what we design today is not built tomorrow, right? It's designed a few years, it's built over the course of a few years, and then it lives a very long time.
Can we only have about a minute or so left? But this is a huge turn because we're talking education. But your background also includes reform-focused design in justice facilities. And I'm thinking about what you're saying about daylighting. When we think about reform prisons, if you will, they haven't done a great job in terms of reforming. And so I wonder, like, daylight, like, how do you think about it if you're building a new one? Are we getting smarter in terms of the actual structure? And forgive me because we got about 40 seconds.
I know. But you're absolutely right. And that's exactly what we're doing. And we've been seeing that when occupants come in, if they're exposed to the right environment, including daylight, they calm down quicker. They're able to get into a more normalized fashion. We're able to reform them faster if they feel like they're giving a normalized environment. And that's really what it's about on correctional facilities.
So it actually makes a difference.
It makes a huge difference.
Well, fascinating. I find architecture. You still love what you're doing?
I love what I do.
it's so great. And it's like, especially right now, I feel like we're at a time coming off the pandemic where people are really rethinking home space, workspace in a big way. And I feel like we're going to see the fruits of those efforts over the next couple of years. Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kimber Heilig. She's president of Buildings and Facilities Division at STV OnSite here at NJIT.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive, stay in prison.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session, and we are hovering near our best levels of the session. You heard Charlie breaking it down. Really some outperformance when it comes to the tech trade, the NASDAQ in particular, up more than 2.2%. We're going to hear from some big tech earnings after the close. I'm thinking about Alphabet. I'm thinking about Microsoft. We've got Texas Instruments. So curious what our next guest
Chipotle
has to say.
Can't forget about Chipotle.
A lot to come.
Let's get to Roger Mortimer. He's portfolio manager at Crane Shares. He joins us this afternoon on the phone from San Francisco. Roger, a question that I've been asking Carol pretty much every break today was, so is the bottom, man? Because we've seen quite a rally from our lows over the last week.
Well, it's been a pretty good day today, that's for sure. You know, we're all kind of sitting in a circle looking at each other, right? There's a feedback loop between the Fed's actions and the market effect. And we're a quarter of the way through earnings season, and earnings generally so far have gone pretty well. About half of companies have beat. And really, the Fed is trying to gauge its actions and its words, you know, to see kind of when the market has started to price that in. And, you know, today the market's feeling okay about it.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you, we're here at live at New Jersey Institute of Technology. We're in front of an audience. Folks are listening, a lot of students here, and we've been talking about sustainability. We've been talking about climate. This is something that you think about, and that's such, you know, really the core of what you're doing at Crane Shares. And we just talked about, was it Blackstone?
Yeah.
BlackRock. You know, just doing another infrastructure fund.
More than $7 billion, 4.5 of which has already been raised.
Right, and thinking about kind of alternative energy and different things. So how do you see it? What do you think are the smart investment plays? Where is money flowing in at this point?
Well, Carol, I think your audience is sitting in exactly the right place. You know, that the energy transition is going to be all about using existing resources more efficiently. And that means digitization. That means control systems that leverage things and enable you to get the maximum out of your existing installed infrastructure. You know, I read somewhere earlier today that the United States is going to need more than 1 million new electricians by 2030. But it's very clear that digital skills and use of data are going to be extremely important in managing energy infrastructure in the future. And, you know, just yesterday, Schlumberger rebranded itself as a technology company and talked about the substantial growth that they see looking forward in these energy transition areas. So it's going to be a convergence of technology and energy. And, you know, I think that's going to be one of the biggest job creation areas of the next 25 years. This is going to be the place that everybody wants to work.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, is what's the time horizon here? And Roger, when we spoke just a couple months ago, I mentioned that, you know, we talked a little bit about how this year has shown us that we are a lot further at the beginning, I guess, or further away from having that energy transition be complete here. So you say 25 years. What does it look like 25 years from now? What are the companies that are owning the space?
Well, I think one thing I'd like to say, Tim, is that these are big, big industries, right? And so you don't need to make much of an inroad into a big industry to build a very, very large business and create a lot of value. The first LNG cargo in the world was shipped in 1959, you know, and now that's 25% of global energy, natural gas. And so hydrogen may be the new area that looks like natural gas, but it took natural gas 50 years to get to 25% of the global infrastructure. But the magnitude of these opportunities are very, very large, right? If people tend to think of Tesla as a company that is an electrification play, and if you look at the amount of global emissions that Tesla would be displacing by its existing size, it's almost too small to measure. So the opportunities in these areas tend to be in big, heavy iron, the utility industries. You know, we like a company called AES, which is a U.S. utility that is getting greener all the time. It has a very big renewable pipeline. Its pipeline's about, its development portfolio is about three times the size of the New Jersey grid. And everything that they build is green, and they are closing coal-fired and gas-fired generating assets at the same time. And, you know, what we know about investors is that there is a growing number of green investors, and that green companies trade at higher valuations. They have a lower cost of capital, and they're often more profitable than dirty companies. And so our focus is on identifying those companies that are transitioning from dirty to clean, and their valuation expands. And so what's really interesting about that is that the social objective of reducing emissions and the financial objective of growing value are aligned, and that's extremely unusual. So we think that companies like AES, a company like Quanta Services, that ticker is PWR, they are essentially the the picks and shovels of the global utility industry. They build capacity and provide specialty infrastructure solutions for companies in that industry. This is where there's going to be very, very significant growth over the next, over the careers of your audience today.
Well, Roger, I want to ask you, and maybe I'll ask the audience, it's really hard. I know you're on radio, can't see this, but show of hands, how many think that nuclear is part of the future? Show of hands.
We've got about a third of people who think nuclear is part of the future.
Pretty substantial. And we had a great conversation with Dr. Michel Bouffedel, professor of civil and environmental engineering here at NJIT, and he talked about how nuclear is really important to the future. Roger, let me ask you, because investment dollars, right, this can make or break in terms of some of the trends to come. How do you think about something like nuclear, which can be such a kind of hot button when it comes to people who like it or people who don't?
Well, nuclear is an acquired taste, Carol. It's kind of the, I'm not sure what the analogy would be. It would be the olives of the food plate. And, you know, some countries are predisposed to embracing nuclear and others are not. And so what I think the way that I would look at it is that nuclear will be a viable option in those countries where policymakers want to pursue that, you know, and that Japan had one of the worst nuclear accidents of the modern age, but they are prepared to go back to nuclear because it's one of the really the only ways that you can add large zero emission base load capacity. And in other countries, the people will voice their opinion and reject the use of nuclear. And that, you know, ultimately that's going to be kind of a policy decision that gets made in individual countries. But at a macro level, nuclear is going to grow substantially. And it's going to be a big part of the future energy mix.
Do you invest that way then? Are you?
Or can you, or is there too much focus on policymakers here, Roger?
Well, we have investments in companies that are transitional, and we have some investments in the value chain. And so one of the companies that we own in the value chain is related to the nuclear business, and that is a Canadian producer called Cameco that is one of the largest uranium producers in the world and also owns other parts of the value chain. You know, and we see both that commodity going higher and the demand for the services and technologies that this company makes, you know, being in growing demand over the next coming years.
I wonder if you have another message for our students who are gathered in front of us here. And you talked about, I think, electricians and, or was it another guest that talked about?
No,
Roger
did.
But is there another thing that when you think about what you're seeing in the investment space and the interest and where investors want to be or just how things are developing, what would you say to them?
I'd say that addressing climate change is going to be the challenge of this generation, and that, you know, what's really interesting is here in the United States, the Inflation Reduction Act is absolutely game-changing in terms of creating economic opportunity in these areas. It provides uncapped incentives, tax credits, that are going to drive huge investment into areas like green hydrogen production. In parts of the country like Texas, which already generates the most wind power, has the largest pipeline network, is the gateway for exporting LNG and ammonia to the rest of the world. These places are going to see tremendous economic boom over the next decade.
All right, we're going to leave it on that. Always fun to talk with you and get some insight, and especially because you've got such a very specific investment space. What do you think?
I thought you were just going to say plastics, Roger, when Carol asked about the future. I'm just dating myself in this room here.
Do you all know the reference?
The Graduate. It's
the
a great
Graduate.
Movie to watch.
Oh, my gosh. All right. That's okay. All right. Our thanks to Roger Mortimer, portfolio manager at Crane Shares. And among its investing strategies includes a climate suite of options. And so great to catch up with him joining us on the phone from San Francisco.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Thank you. Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.